Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Scott Murphy, and welcome to this special edition of New Horror Express, where we launch our brand new monthly series, New Horror Express's Guilty Pleasures, as part of the hashtag Horror Not Fear campaign organized by our good friends Bloodhound Pix. The idea of the campaign is to deepen ties within the indie horror community, as well as to offer bonus content for our respective audiences in these difficult times over the next year. In aid of this, I, along with some special guest co-hosts, will look at a different guilty pleasure movie as picked by you, the listener, between a choice of two each month based on a certain theme from now until June 2021. Now, we here at New Horror Express know the term guilty pleasure is both problematic and subjective. Firstly, because one person's guilty pleasure is maybe not another's. For example, some may consider the likes of Father's Day or Deathgasm as guilty pleasure movies, but I think they are legitimately great. Secondly, because the term guilty pleasure implies a certain sort of shame in liking these films. But rest assured, there is no shame here. I don't have any shame about any of the movies I like. So my take on it is this. There's certain type of movies that I enjoy, but I recognize are bad films. And if I was personally to review them, I would give them certainly under 3 stars. Now that that explanation is out of the way, on today's episode, we got you to pick between 2 bad Dracula movies. First, Dracula 2000, or Argento's Dracula, also known as Dracula 3D. You picked Dracula 2000, the second feature film from Canadian film director Patrick Lussier, who is probably most well known for directing the My Bloody Valentine remake and Drive Angry. So here to talk to me about Dracula 2000 is 2 fellow great Canadian filmmakers, Knuckleball director Mike Peterson and True Fiction director Braden Croft, both previous guests on the show who we're delighted to have back on. So, hi Braden, hi Mike.
Hey, what's up?
So the first question is, have you both seen Dracula 2000 before, and how did it compare? Was there anything different in, you know, that you misremembered or, just popped out at you differently than the first time you saw it?
Yeah, sure. This is Mike here speaking. Excuse me. I thought I had seen it before, but when I watched it, I realized I had not seen it before, but I was certainly aware of it enough that I knew it was Gerard Butler in it and a few other actors. So it was, it was my first time definitely watching the whole movie. And I have to say, overall, I enjoyed it in a very specific way.
Yeah, it was my first time, but along with Mike, I recognized certain scenes. And I guess there's no spoiler reveal here. I think everyone's seen the film if they're listening, but the Judas Iscariot part at the end was something I remember seeing. So whether it was chunks here and there, I definitely didn't recognize some parts, but on this time watching it, I was pleasantly surprised. I actually liked the film more than I would have guessed by the title. Let's just say that.
Well, let's first talk about the title, Dracula 2000. It's an updating of Dracula's. In this Dracula mythology, the novel Dracula exists and is obviously only partly a work of fiction. And if you can say anything about this movie, it very much does exactly what it says on the tin. It both has Dracula in it, and it is very, very, very 2000. From the long leather trench coats, to the sexy young thing cast, to the having a pop star in the cast, to the new metal soundtrack, to the MTV-style visuals, it has got everything that screams, this was made in the year 2000.
Yeah, even a Virgin Superstore selling CDs, which wasn't around much longer after that, I don't think.
Yeah, that felt like the most on-the-nose product placement I've ever seen in a film. T-shirts, logos, it was everywhere.
The one thing with that is the, I don't know if you remember, they have that fight in the parking lot, and there's a Virgin store truck.
Yes.
With the big logo on the side of the van, and I was wondering, like, there, I don't think that's a real thing. I think they made that for the film. I don't, like, that's, did they have a, you know, like a branded van that they drove around to events or gave out CDs in public squares or something? That felt like a prop for the film to put in the background of that specific sequence because they had some kind of contractual obligation or something. And yeah, whether that's true or not, I can't say, but it certainly felt heavily placed.
Absolutely. I think, like, the Virgin stuff does get kind of ridiculous. You know, like, there's so many times where it's like they're either in the store or, like you say, I think the fight scene is the worst one. Like, there's other moments where it's like, oh, you know, the lead female character, Mary, is, like, wearing her, like, Virgin t-shirt, like, the first time you see her. And, you know, when Jared Butler's watching the Monster Magnet video, which is apparently the great sign of moral decay in society, which he really liked. There's, like, you know, he's watching it on a video that's, like, got the Virgin logo at the bottom and stuff like that. It's just, I don't know. Yeah, they must have paid a bunch of cash just to be advertised throughout the movie. I mean, I thought that the product placement, it's very rare that I've seen product placement that heavy in a film. It's certainly outside of a Bond film. Because I was thinking, like, I remember there was, I think it was Casino Royale is the one that has, like, it advertised, like, Virgin Airlines. He goes to it, and Richard Branson even has a cameo and all that.
Right. That's too funny, man. And it's, like, you made a good point saying this felt so 2000 for so many reasons. And one of the things, like, the Virgin Records, I wonder if people, while it is 20 years from then, you know, another decade, people are not going to know what the hell that was. It's kind of like the Clockwork Orange scene through the record shop. This is kind of like that last punch of what a record store used to be, because, God, when did those stores start dying? 10 years later?
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Maybe even sooner in some instances.
Yeah, I think so. I think they maybe, because Virgin's like a UK company, they maybe lasted slightly longer in the UK than in the States. I'm not sure about that. But certainly the kind of late 2000s, I would say, like, you know, a lot of them started going under. They started kind of streamlining down before they just eventually kind of folded.
And I think some of the, I didn't do my research on it, but there was Paramount 5000, Linkin Park, Slayer, I think there was a Pantera song. It's just like some really, really big bands. Are they signed to Virgin? Is that fair to assume that they were probably on a label?
I actually don't know if all of them were signed to Virgin at the time. And actually, in terms of, like, the research that I did on the background of the movie, like, that's not, it's not research I did. So I don't know if, like all those artists, like you say, because there is a bunch of big names, System of a Down, Slayer. I think, yeah, Marilyn Manson's on there, I think. Monster Magnet obviously have a prominent scene in the movie. So I don't know if all of them were attached to Virgin at the time. I wouldn't imagine so. I think some of those bands definitely had different labels at the time.
Almost feels like the compilation, the official soundtrack for the film, was every much a product as the film itself, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's another thing that makes it a kind of time capsule movie. I mean, like, when, you know, the end credits come on and, like, One Step Closer by, you know, Linkin Park hits the end credits, it's like, whoa. This very much hits memories of being 15. For me, listener, I'm just coming up on 35, so, like, I was teen at this stage.
But overall, I enjoyed this movie in a lot of ways. Like, it doesn't feel like anyone's phoning it in. Feels like everyone took it really seriously. It definitely feels of a certain type of movie that happened in the 90s, where they wanted to make action horror films. But it's like the perfect kind of movie, like Beastmaster or something like that, where you would watch it on a Sunday, you know, morning, afternoon on a cable TV channel or something like that in the background, or even today's version of most Netflix films, where you can kind of watch them while you're doing something else. And that's sort of the, you know, I don't think it requires a lot of attention, this movie, in terms of a deep watch. You don't need to do a heavy reading on it as you're watching it, because I don't think there's too much to, you know, below the surface. But you've got great performances from Christopher Plummer, whose character of Van Helsing feels like it's kind of like the basis or sort of a semi-inspiration for, I forget the actor's name, the guy from Pirates of the Caribbean who was in that TV series, The Strain. Feels like it's in the same kind of wheelhouse as that.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed that. Omar Epps is one of the, you know, the poster titled actors. So he must've been one of the big names at that point in time for this movie, but strangely enough, he doesn't have sort of the big role. And then this is when Gerard Butler was more interested in a different type of movie, or maybe just taking what was coming his way.
I think he was kind of taking what was coming his way. He hadn't really got big yet. At least, like, he had done supporting roles in a couple of things, but this was like his first leading role in a big-ish movie. You know, he didn't really become, I think it was more like Phantom of the Opera. He started to get more famous and then obviously became massive with 300, which is like 7 years from now from the perspective of this movie.
Yeah. And Johnny Lee Miller, God, Trainspotting, dude. As soon as I saw him, I was like, Sick Boy is in other movies? What? I freaked out. I loved it. Jennifer Esposito, that's another name. She kind of went, I can't recall the actress's name, but she's in all the Fast and the Furious films.
You mean Michelle Rodriguez? Are you thinking of Michelle Rodriguez?
Yeah. In watching it, I thought, are they trying to groom her into a Rodriguez kind of actress here? Because, God, there was a slew of, like Mike said, the action horror films. Is it Underworld? Resident Evil was coming out.
Yeah, there was like a boom of that in the early 2000s. Although they did all happen after this movie. Like Resident Evil was like 2002. Underworld, I think, was 2003. There did seem to be this kind of early 2000s action horror kind of thing that they were really pushing.
Yeah, I appreciate the revisionist kind of idea, because we've all seen Dracula a million times, and really, well, this is just a personal opinion, but Bram Stoker's Dracula with Francis Ford Coppola's Envisioned Man, like that blew me away. I don't know. It almost got beyond I'm spacing on his name, Todd Browning's version of Dracula, which I don't think you'll ever really top. But what are you going to do? Are you going to remake Dracula again, or are you going to add something new to it? So, I mean, his backstory, that reveal, I thought was pretty fun. I know a lot of diehards probably rolled in their grave on that, but I thought it was cool. You could throw in new ideas, little nods to old vampire films, like the Nosferatu skull when they go into Van Helsing's little Dracula containment layer. Like, all that stuff is just fun, lighthearted fun.
Yeah, I do feel like, even though, you know, like Mike was saying, you know, you can't really dive too deep into this movie in terms of it's pretty light watching. I do think that there's like, they're not necessarily super well executed, but there is kind of neat ideas in the movie. Like the Judas Iscariot twist is quite a neat idea. The, like, how Van Helsing extended his life is quite a neat twist, is quite a neat idea. So there is, like, little bits in the movie that you're thinking, oh, yeah, these are quite nice little twists on things.
Exactly. And I'm looking at the writers here, and, like, Scott Derrickson, as everyone kind of knows now, he's breaking out as a director. I guess he broke out in 2005 with Exorcism of Emily Rose and Sinister and now Doctor Strange. But even Aaron Kruger was in this. And I remember when he was just bursting on the scene with Arlington Road and eventually The Ring. So there's a lot of punch-up writers on this film.
Yeah. The, apparently, the weren't massively, the producers, like, you know, obviously Miramax Dimension Films made this, and they weren't super happy with the original script in some ways, although they apparently they kept like the basis of the story. And yeah, like you say, Scott Derrickson was one of the people to kind of do a kind of script doctoring job on the movie. And I don't know what you guys feel about that. I do feel like there is a kind of mishmash to the movie in terms of, obviously, Dimension, the Weinsteins had an idea of what this movie was, a kind of trashy, sexy movie. And Patrick Lussier obviously had a slightly different idea, a slightly kind of more serious movie with a kind of glossy look to it, but a kind of more solemn movie. And like, both of those movies exist within the movie that was made. I feel that, I don't know if either of you felt that kind of mishmash happening there either.
Yeah, it feels like it's kind of going in a couple different directions, and the story itself, like, there's a whole bunch of characters with loose ends or that don't really pay off in strong ways. Like, you've got what I assume is a very early role by Nathan Fillion as the priest. And he sort of is, like, there's not really, and if you cut that scene out, I don't think it actually makes any difference, because it doesn't really do a lot. I mean, it's nice to see him in a movie. I like him as an actor. But it's got a bunch of those weird kind of story threads that don't really build on themselves. And you have that world of Van Helsing where you're dealing with these kind of, you know, fun antique style, invented props for the film of, you know, shooting, silver bolts at people and things like that. But then you have the Virgin Records side of it, which is, you know, an awful space to shoot in just because it's like so bright and flat. It's got a, yeah, a bunch of weird contradictory type of ideas in it that don't seem to quite gel. But I mean, there's such a, like, a talented group of people working on this film. You have a bunch of Cronenberg regulars with Carol Spear and Denise Cronenberg, I think. I think I've got her name right. Who work on all Cronenberg stuff and are really talented, you know, department heads. Like artists and craftspeople, that, and you can see their work in the film, and it's like really nice, the work they do. It just doesn't feel like any idea ever quite followed through 100%.
Yeah, I think looking back on it too, you could question, oh, are they trying to balance too many approaches, a serious approach, a campy approach, a teen, you know, millennial fan service sort of thing? But if I'm placing myself back in that time, I kind of feel like they probably went into it thinking, like, we're going to update Dracula. It's going to be fucking badass. I'm not sure if I can swear on this.
Yeah, you can. Go ahead. I mark all the episodes as explicit, just in case. Even some of the episodes aren't even don't even have swear words in them, but, like, I just in case.
I don't really talk like a sailor much, but anyway, the odd one will slip. But yeah, I think they went in going to make a serious badass film that teens are going to love, and it's going to kind of inject some new blood into Dracula, bring it into the new millennia, so to speak. But us looking back, there's so many choices, like, that Mike was hitting on, that what were they thinking? Like, how could that age well? How can that not be taken as a firm step into camp and a little silly? And I don't know. I think it was probably one direction with many writers trying to nail that hip, cool, 2000, edgy Dracula in the new millennia.
But the whole thing is, like, incredibly PG, right? Like, there's no real violence in any of the fight scenes or the kills.
That's true. Yeah. Like, there's, it's kind of one of those things of, like, most of the, a lot of the kills kind of happen off screen, and you get that kind of, like, blood smash across the wall, or, you know, across some surface kind of thing that happens kind of repeatedly.
Yeah, and then they do that one thing I always hate in movies where they have the person that they're trying to get and then they don't follow through. So they've got Johnny Lee Miller and the ladies are holding him and then they start talking. It's like, come on. You've spent like 5 minutes trying to kill the guy. Now you've got him and now you're going to, you know, monologue for a bit here.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like...
Frustrating.
I think that, I mean, that's another thing that, that made it like super 2000s. And also that scene, you know, in particular, again, that was kind of like, it felt very 2000s when the brides arrive to kind of kill Johnny Lee, Johnny Lee Miller's character. And it's, you know, Jerry Ryan, Jennifer Esposito, Colleen Fitzpatrick. They all turn up in slow-mo like Charlie's Angels. And again, like you said, you know, there's some solemn bits in the movie, and they couldn't have like recorded that scene and been like, yep, people won't find this hilarious.
Yeah, but I mean, it's cool to see all these great people working on a project and seeing their work and, you know, being able to kind of isolate what they've done in some way, because it does, a lot of these elements do feel isolated and like they're not quite working together. So that was kind of enjoyable. And I did like the props in it.
I was going to say, when I was watching it, I kind of got this vibe. Do you guys remember the movie Demon Knight? Tales from the Crypt?
Tales from the Crypt, yeah.
Right, right. So the Judas Iscariot, like that little backstory, they did the same thing with, you know, what's in this guy's magical canteen. It's the blood of Christ. And we, you know, it's kind of an old biblical throwback. I felt like if they went in that direction where they embraced a little bit of the silly nature of an idea of basically having Dracula frozen in a basement and reviving him, would it have hit better? Is, would the times have allowed that sort of that meta tongue-in-cheek approach, or would it have flunked hard then, harder than it may have flunked as it exists today? Like, well, what's your take? Do you think if they took it in that direction, would it have played better? Would it have aged sweeter?
I don't know, but you, like, when you're making a movie, you're not thinking about how it's aging, I don't think. Like, no one can really predict that exactly.
So I mean, sure.
Like, I don't think anyone's making a movie and being like, well, you know, in 20 years when someone watches this, is the CD store going to be a weird idea or something? Like, it's a very difficult thing to do and really would put you outside of your own project in a strange way, rather than focusing on the, you know, the project and just making it live within whatever the environment that you're creating is. But that Judas Iscariot idea, I feel like I've seen that in a couple of other movies, but I mean, it's definitely an idea, like it's about, you know, Judas Iscariot betrays Jesus and then he's basically doomed to walk the world for the rest of eternity. So the idea is sound, and I've definitely seen it somewhere else and I just can't remember where else I've seen it, but, and I don't know if it was before or after that, but it's definitely a, you know, a fun play on sort of those biblical ideas and putting them into the horror movie mythology.
I think, well, like
even down to the silver, I thought was a very clever idea. But one thing I just couldn't get over was Van Helsing had him locked up for a century, basically. And what defeats him in the end? Being hung. And like, was it a magical combination of being hung from a crucifix and in the sun? Or was it just the sun?
I think it was replicating how he first died.
Yeah, I think that was just for the imagery. Like, yeah, you know, because it's a flashback of how he hung himself after the crucifixion. And then, yeah, I think it's just for the kind of matching up imagery. And then, yeah, he was burnt by the sun.
But this time he doesn't do it himself, whereas the first time he would have done it himself. So he, you know, under that type of Christian idea, you would, you know, be doomed for eternity if you committed suicide. This time he kills himself, or he's killed the same, basically in the exact same way, but this time he's not the author of that. So maybe that's why. I mean, we're probably reading much more into it than maybe it was ever discussed by them, but you know, usually these things do get discussed on a set, and there's something underneath all this stuff, and I could see that as at least being a rational, logical reason. And in this case, he wasn't the author of his, of it. He didn't commit suicide this time, but it still replicates the way he was supposed to die originally.
I think, like, obviously the director, Patrick Lussier, was obviously interested in that take and probably wanted to go harder down that road. Because, like, having seen the sequels, I watched the sequels as well, Dracula, they did two more, Dracula 2 and Dracula 3. I can't remember, they have subtitles as well. Dracula 3, I think Dracula 3 is Legacy, and it's Dracula 2, I can't remember the subtitle. But anyway, they kind of go more into the kind of, lean harder into the kind of religious thing. And yeah, but again, it is actually, those movies are kind of like an odd mixture as well, because again, they generally have quite a solemn tone to them, but they also, like this movie, have like all the kind of Bond style one-liners that, you know, which makes it kind of odd. And there is a certain trashiness. Oh, it's not the same. It's they're made, they look different. They look more solemn as well. Like they don't look as kind of heavily stylized, and maybe that's because they're direct to video and like because of lesser budgets or whatever, but they're not as heavily stylized as this movie.
The one thing I thought they executed amazingly well was the special effects though. Like they really held together really nicely. Like it doesn't feel cheap. It feels well thought out, well designed. And you know, a lot of that stuff would have been a lot harder to pull off back then, like the flashback to Judas Iscariot and the cross and all that stuff. Like that sort of hyper reality that they create there is great, and I'm sure it's just a green screen and a couple props in the foreground.
I mean,
it almost looks like a little backdrop. Oh god, what did they do on Bram Stoker's Dracula? Like the painted background, and then you have foreground elements, forced perspective. It really did look super stylized in that way, which I really dug. Like, I don't think we do it enough these days, because it's just, why would you do it when you could go full realistic with CG, I guess? But you don't have that same ethereal feel.
Absolutely not. And I did like a bunch of that stuff. Like, I thought a bunch of that stuff was really good. And I really liked the kind of the colors and the look of the film. And, you know, when you're talking about that flashback, when we see Mary in that flashback, and yeah, she kind of emerges from this kind of four-poster bed with these red curtains around it. I was weird because, like, I know it came out in the same year, so it wouldn't have been an influence, but I did kind of think, like, oh, maybe they saw, like, an early cut of The Cell or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it was actually a really good year for movies. I was looking through some of the other movies that came out that year, and, I mean, they had a lot to kind of you know, go against, like, you know, like you said, The Cell, Shadow of the Vampire, Gingersnaps, American Psycho. Like it was a pretty good movie year. So
they just squeaked it out December 22nd, 2000.
Yeah,
but it was released as Dracula 2001 here, because they didn't squeak out here in the UK. It was released in 2001, so it's Dracula 2001 over here.
But the 2000 thing is pretty irrelevant, isn't it?
Yeah,
like it's like it could be any year.
Anything 2000.
I mean, year between 2000 and 2004, probably.
But it plays no, like, it doesn't hold anything story wise or thematic.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's more the kind of the look of the movie and certain things around the movie. Like we've talked before about the scene that has the Virgin Megastorage van that has the big heavy product placement there. And that's where they have the obligatory Matrix style fight scene that every movie between the Matrix coming out in 99 and about 2004 was required to have if they were an action movie or any kind of like a major action element in it.
But this would have, like, there was like a lot of anxiety at this time around the Y2K bug, right?
Yeah, they thought, absolutely.
You know, when the clocks rolled back, like, you know, all hell was going to break loose and airplanes were going to drop out of the sky and things like that. But they don't touch on any, like, that actually would have been a fun kind of environment to play in this world, to sort of do some world building around some of the anxiety that was happening around that time. And I'm sure you could play the, you know, his lack of knowledge around technology as a fun or interesting element around.
That was really surprising, is when Dracula was so well equipped to adapt to all the changes that have gone on since. Well, at first I thought he was supposed to be off Vlad Tepes, so I was like, okay, 500 years later, maybe. But this is, God, when did Judas kill himself? 33 years after the birth of Christ, roughly. So it's been almost 2,000 years. He was just strolling through clubs, didn't look twice. He's like, oh yeah, phone.
Well, not only that, think of like where he woke up. This guy woke up on an airplane.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And he doesn't talk of it at all. He's just like, whoa. Like, there's not even a moment where he looks out and he's like, what the fuck? Or, you know, making a goofy comment about, you know, how anyone can fly like a bat now or whatever. kind of silly line they could come up with. But yeah, it's a strange thing not to acknowledge.
It is a strange thing not to acknowledge. I mean, the only thing that could possibly gloss over it. So essentially, he's been around as a vampire for a long time. There's a flashback that shows Van Helsing capturing him.
So, horse and buggy times, right?
So he's been apparently, as far as we know, according to the movie, he has been in a coffin since the 1800s.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the and it's not like
narrative explanation that might go some way to explain how the hell he knows anything about anything in the modern world is there is an implication that he has a psychic link from within the coffin to Mary, Van Helsing's daughter.
Yeah, sort of.
That's about it.
And that's the other thing is, like, she has all these kind of, like, weird waking dream type moments where she can inhabit some kind of perspective around him, which is weird because it's a perspective that's sort of fly on the wall perspective. It's not based on anything. So she just kind of sucked into his environment. But it's, the dogs are barking, guys. But anyways, yeah, so it was really strange. And then how she reacted to some of that stuff was like completely, like, didn't feel like the appropriate reaction. Like, she sees her friend get killed, and then she's just kind of like a little bit shook.
Yeah, that's kind of true. I think she's just kind of like mild. I mean, she's only even mildly traumatized when she finds her father's dead body. They're like, oh, that's a shame. And then we move on pretty quickly from that.
It's because of all that music that they're listening to that heavy metal music that they're listening to at the Virgin Superstore. It's, you know, just completely made them, you know, non-responsive to violence.
They're angst immune, man.
Right? They're just, yeah, it's just all nothing phases them, I guess. Just, you need to blame it on heavy metal, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, I suppose that was, again, like a popular thing at the time to do. You know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was one of those periods. Like, it was a quainter time, pre-9/11, where, you know, like, people were just like, let's blame Marilyn Manson for Columbine. Back in the good old days when school shootings used to shock people, not to get too political.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. But yeah, when was, because I someone bought me a ticket to a Marilyn Manson concert around that time, and that would have, maybe it was a few years earlier, but there was people like protesting outside the concert, and then he ripped out pages from a Bible and all this stuff.
It would be around that time. It would be for like that tour kind of thing, because he released an album in 2000 called Hollywood in the Shadow of the Valley of Death in 2000, and Columbine had happened in 99. I can't remember when in 99. And then obviously there was all these things that came out that apparently a big Marilyn Manson fan, so everybody was like, let's blame Marilyn Manson for these guys shooting a school up.
Yeah, 1996 I think was that year that you're referencing, Mike, and that was the Antichrist Superstar record, because I remember I was, you know, a little kid listening to that, and my dad giving me the talk, like, "Well, Judas Priest, well, they're a good band, and Kiss, and they're fine, and Alice Cooper, but this is evil, this is wrong, you can't listen to this." And you're right, everyone was protesting, and like, as we know in America, the more you protest something, the more you're just going to get more attention and become successful. So
it was a really dull concert. That's what I remember from it. I was really disappointed. I wasn't a big Marilyn Manson fan, so you know, I was just really going for the spectacle, and it really let me down. That's all I remember from the concert. I just left being like, man, these guys are wasting their time protesting. There's nothing going on here. Controversial. They should just go watch the show. They'll see.
Yeah. This is not the direction that I imagined the podcast going in. But I have to say, like, for me, that is a pure time capsule, because like the soundtrack for this movie was kind of like loads of the bands on it was like the soundtrack of like my teenage years. Of that time, you know, there's a lot of the bands I was listening to and kind of still listen to: Monster Magnet, Slayer, you know, System of a Down, Pantera, you know, like all those bands.
And it makes you think, like, if this movie was released today, and updated for today's audience, would that soundtrack look any form whatsoever as it was in 2000? Because it's hard to believe that those tunes would be played on the radio, let alone, you know, like, it's just times have changed so much. That's way too heavy for audiences these days.
I think there was a time in horror in the early 2000s where it was very, very popular to put heavy metal on your soundtrack. Like, there was a time where it almost seemed obligatory that you had to have, like, a heavy metal soundtrack and a rapper as one of your cast members. Like, it just seemed like one of those kind of things that happened in the early 2000s.
Well, it's still the music of youth, which it feels like this is, like, you know, aimed at teenagers.
Yeah.
The level of violence and kind of the, you know, the not really deep, kind of the facade of edge. Like, Slayer's an awesome band, and they are edgy. But if you throw them on a soundtrack, one song, it doesn't really add edge, but it implies edge. It feels like they were playing around with that idea so that, you know, they could, you know, some marketing guys like, you know, we can aim this at teenagers because heavy metal and hip hop are the, you know, the sounds that the kids are listening to.
I think that's part of the friction at the heart of the movie of obviously Lucier wanting to make this kind of movie. There was like this kind of cool updating of Dracula and kind of make it a bit more youth focused, but I think Dimension Film, because there was like reshoots, and Dimension Films and particularly Harvey Weinstein very much wanted this to be a film directly targeted to the Scream, I Know What You Did Last Summer, urban legends type audience that had built in the kind of late 90s.
Right. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. But I mean, it's a decent soundtrack.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think
the soundtrack's more cohesive thematically than I think the movie is.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. I do think, like, watching the movie back then, it was just like a kind of fun, trashy movie. And I think for the most part, it is still a fun, trashy movie. Mm-hmm. But knowing that Harvey Weinstein ordered recuts, like reshoots for the movie, and ordered the movie to be quote unquote sexed up, and knowing what we know about Harvey Weinstein, some of the elements that happen in the movie, particularly the scene in the mental asylum with Jennifer Esposito, feel
right
kind of creepy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You can certainly, you know, you can create like this idea that there was some weird conversation between a creepy guy asking someone to do something that has no fucking business being there, or has no real reason to be there other than, you know, he's trying to make it sexy and maybe he's watching the monitor.
That is a scene that sticks out as me as being the blatantly the most sleazy scene in the movie, and I really don't think there's a point in having it there. And I do feel like all the kind of sucking double entendres maybe didn't exist originally, although maybe they did.
Well, and it's funny, they didn't really apply that same rationale to Gerard Butler, which, why not, right? There's always that homosexual undertones of Dracula's story. So is that not in vogue? That wasn't hip then, I guess?
Presumably not. I don't know. I don't know how much Gerard Butler would be into that. Probably Harvey Weinstein probably definitely wasn't into that. Yeah, like you say, that's an interesting road to go down. And also, like, he's, you know, there is the way he's presented, you know, with the kind of tousled hair and stuff like that, it would have been an easy road to go down as well. But no.
Yeah, he feels like he's in a soap opera more, though.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
My wife couldn't stop commenting on how perfect his skin was, and I was like, he's a vampire. Come on.
Hey, he's an attractive fella. And it's actually nice to see him act. Like, I enjoyed watching him act in this.
I was going to ask that. What did you both think of his performance? I thought he was relatively wooden, but like, I mean, he wasn't terrible or anything. He had a certain sort of charisma, but I wanted to hear your guys' thoughts on what you thought of his performance.
Yeah, I thought it was fine. I mean, he's not working with a lot, you know.
Yeah,
like, there's like, what's the arc of Dracula in this story? He wants that daughter or whatever of Van Helsing. Is that his daughter or granddaughter? I couldn't figure that out.
Yeah, no, it's supposed to be his daughter. Well, I don't understand at what point had her. like, you know, it seems like obviously he had been injecting the leech blood, extending his life. So it was never clear if she's like way older than she actually looks, or she is the age she is supposed to be, and Van Helsing just had her old and it was never established.
I thought it was always kind of a cross between Van Helsing's DNA plus Dracula's. So it's kind of like she's the blood daughter, but not literally the daughter.
Yeah.
So I think that's where that came in. And I would assume, because she would know if she's 200 years old, but that was never crossed. So it's kind of like Van Helsing was keeping busy for like quite a long time.
I couldn't figure that out either. It just seemed like where was her mother? What happened there? Maybe they said, and I wasn't paying attention, but I don't remember anything about that happening. And then why did he hide her there specifically? He just seemed weird. Like he kind of just didn't really set her up for success.
So what did you think of the performance, Braden? Mike obviously quite liked it.
I thought going in, I knew he was one of his first big roles, at least on a theatrical sense, but I was prepared for the worst, and I thought they restrained him a bit. Like Mike was saying, they didn't give him much to work with. But with that said, I didn't think what he played with was all that bad. I thought he was subdued, and I thought he was muted, but and maybe that's how it came across as wooden, but I was surprised, and I thought he did a pretty decent job as Dracula for what they gave him.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I watched that kind of behind-the-scenes documentary. It was just a short documentary. Oh, cool. Watching YouTube. It's like 10 minutes long. And I was quite amused by something Christopher Plummer said in it. I have to say, seemed to take the role. I assumed it was like a payday for him. But like watching this, he talks quite seriously about it. And he seems quite into being Van Helsing. But he said this thing about Gerard Butler, where it was like, he has a certain stillness to him, which is remarkable for somebody his age, which I couldn't work out if that was a genuine compliment to his acting skills or Christopher Plummer thought he was a bit wooden.
I think that's a compliment, right? Because it doesn't feel like he needs to be busy to hold the screen. Like he's not working off of tics, or you know, having to hold a cigarette in his hand and flick it all the time, or eating in a scene, or you know what I mean? Like he feels comfortable with what he's got, that he can just hold the frame and he doesn't need to do more than what's required in the role and isn't relying on any gimmicks or tics. So I think that's a compliment.
Yeah, I think amongst the acting circle, like I know sitting in a lot of acting casting sessions, being a little camera boy watching these guys work, a huge difference between some of the more mature and experienced ones where they can hold the scene with stillness, whether that's seated, standing, whatever. And the more immature or the budding actors were very busy, very animated and talking with their hands. It was more theatrical. And on screen, obviously, you don't need to do that. So he probably meant that as a pretty good compliment.
And to be fair, even though he wasn't super young, because he would have been like 30 at the time, I suppose he hadn't actually been, I don't think he'd actually been acting for that many years in movies, because he had been a lawyer in Glasgow before transitioning into acting full time. So
he was a lawyer.
Yeah, he's trained as a lawyer.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, I went to law school. I don't know how long he practiced law, or you know, if he practiced law full time or whatever. But he certainly went to law school.
That blows me away when people hold these professions that are not just day jobs. They're committed, very professional people, like authors that are lawyers, and it happens all the time. And now you're telling me Gerard Butler is a lawyer and an actor?
Well, I mean, he's not a practicing lawyer. He has a law degree for sure. Yeah,
it's like Dolph Lundgren. When I found out he had
a chemical engineering
PhD.
Yeah,
yeah, he's an engineer.
Like, that's absolutely mind-boggling. Not to mention he's a professional fighter, legitimately, before his career, and then obviously an action stud. So, I don't know. I think we got shortchanged on some genetic ladder here.
Well, that's just everyone in Sweden, I think.
Everyone in Sweden. No, like, I do think there should be rules. I do think that you shouldn't be able to be intellectually talented and physically talented. In terms, like the Dolph Lundgren thing, I don't believe you should be able to be a 6'5" karate champion action star and also hold a PhD. you should choose a lane and that's it. You know,
I think he's being greedy.
It's like that meme where you have God pouring in ingredients. He's like, all right, good looks, a little little intelligence. Oops. It's like he poured everything in.
Yeah. It's not fair. It's not fair. As someone as a 5'8", skinny 5'8" with little physical talents and only mild intellectual talents, you know, it's just, it doesn't seem fair.
Well, you can't win every battle, I guess.
No. Does Dolph Lundgren have a horror podcast? No, he doesn't.
Exactly.
Exactly.
But I heard he's starting one up. Gonna win a Pulitzer
Prize. First episode is going to be in Dracula 2000. It's going to be even better than this. Oh no, the nightmare.
That's right. Watch your back. But yeah, I don't know. But I did overall, I enjoyed this movie, and I don't know that I'd seek it out to watch it again, but if it was playing again while I was doing something else, like writing emails or looking up photos for some reason, I would probably leave it on.
Yeah, it drummed up some interest for me to at least watch a couple of the sequels to see, you know, where they take it from there, because the story itself, again, I thought the story was interesting. There's something there.
Did you say,
how do they add to that? I don't know.
Are there sequels to this?
There are two sequels, yes.
Oh my God.
There's a trilogy.
Wow, I had no idea.
Well, the same director, no less, right?
Yeah, it's the same director. The same director directed all three movies. This, Dracula 2 Ascension, and Dracula 2 Legacy, which the Dracula 2 was released in 2003 and Dracula 3 was released in 2005, but they were kind of filmed back to back. And they kind of take the story in a slightly different direction, and they focus more on the kind of religious element of it and this kind of story of like the only true way to kill Dracula is to give him absolution. And they're quite fun. The most fun elements of them is like Jason Scott Lee plays this kind of axe-kicking priest, which is, you know, like he is not featured enough in the second movie, but he's featured quite extensively in
the third. Kicks ass for the Lord, is what you're saying?
He does kick ass for the Lord.
Got Roy Scheider in it too. Holy smokes, I love him.
Yeah, he's got Roy Scheider. And the third one has Rutger Hauer in it.
I also
love
him. Because
Dracula's played by like a different actor in each movie. So there's like the second one, he's played by a British soap actor called Stephen Billington, because like these movies have this some kind of weird thing where they all feature at least one British cast member for no apparent reason.
Why wouldn't these guys want to carry, at least in the sequels? I could get if Gerard Butler had better opportunities, but I wonder why, if they're shooting back to back, they would have to get a new Dracula. It's not something conceptually that makes sense, I'm assuming.
Oh no, they filmed the sequels back to back. Like there's a gap between, there's a 3-year gap between this movie and the first sequel, the second movie. But the sequels 2 and 3, they were filmed back to back.
You know what I wish? I wish they had kept the naming convention so that it was Dracula 2001 was the sequel, and that they found that monolith on the planet and that it was really a big coffin. And then it's like Space Dracula. That'd be cool. That's what I want to see.
Yeah, the really confusing thing about it is there is a movie called Dracula 3000, which is an even worse movie. Like this movie is like trashy fun, but like Dracula 3000 is genuinely terrible, which a lot of people think is the sequel to this movie, but the sequel to this movie is called Dracula 2.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
No, it doesn't make any sense at all. It's very poorly marketed.
The poster for Dracula 3000 is cool.
The poster, like the thing, yeah, with the, yeah, it's pretty cool poster. It's not a cool movie. It's probably one of the worst Draculas ever. There's certainly a kind of so bad it's good kind of element to Dracula 3000. I would say this still counts as a guilty pleasure movie, Dracula 2000, but you could make a sort of argument for it being okay-ish, but no, Dracula 3000 is genuinely in the kind of so bad. It's a very funny kind of category.
Well, it doesn't have Casper Van Diem and Coolio, you know, so.
On the other end of Dracula's, did either of you see the Jack Palance Dracula?
I have not seen the Jack Palance Dracula, although I have heard about it. And apparently, even though it is very, very weird that Jack Palance is Dracula, because most people imagine Dracula as being a somewhat kind of sexual being, or the kind of romantic hero, of romantic anti-hero, I should say. And Jack Palance is very much not. Like, it's apparently quite good. So what were your kind of thoughts?
Yeah. It was one of the earliest Draculas I saw as a kid. And I remembered how, I won't spoil it for you, but the way he dies stuck in my mind more than any other Dracula film since. And it took me forever to figure out who this was, because it's a Dan Curtis film, and I just could not find it. And I couldn't remember Jack Palance, his performance in it. But watching it recently, I thought, goddamn, it should be better well known for what it is. I can't say it's the best form of Dracula, but it stands on its own merit, and it takes a bold choice in where they want to go with it, and especially the ending. It was just, it felt proper. It felt right. That's all I should say, because you got to see it.
Okay. Mike, have you seen the Jack Palance?
I've never seen it. I know of it, but I've never seen it. But I like Jack Palance, so I probably should.
Yeah, 74, so he was still a young buck of sorts.
He was young when he was old. He was doing one-handed push-ups.
It's crazy, right? Talk about another guy. He was a boxer when he was young. Professional.
Some interesting people who have played Dracula, because I was just thinking of like 70s Draculas as well. There's like Frank Langella played Dracula in the 70s as well. There's a one with him in it.
Okay, Jack Palance, 6'3". I'm just checking if he's got a PhD in anything. One sec. I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I mean, like, I'm sure he could have scared somebody into giving him a PhD, but it's not the same thing, is it?
That's an honorary one.
That's classic.
But yeah, it's hard to dig deep into this movie, that's for sure.
I think so. I think it's not a movie to kind of deep dive into the great themes of it. But I do think there is a lot of fun to be had with this movie. I think it is, there's many elements that are naff. There is elements that are genuinely quite good, I would say, across the board. Like, most of the acting's pretty good. It looks good. There is obviously many naff elements to it. It's very much of its time. It has, I would say, the sex scene between Gerard Butler and the character of Lucy, played by Colin Fitzpatrick, is up there with one of the kind of hilariously bad sex scenes. I think it's up there with like Showgirls and Watchmen, and it is one of the most hilariously bad I've seen.
Why is Dracula having sex anyways? I never understood that.
I don't understand why. I don't think this was always a thing. I don't know at what point he became like this kind of romantic kind of anti-hero villain. I don't know what that's about, but I mean, when they're having sex on the ceiling, that is, it's a laugh out loud moment. I don't know how anybody filmed that with a straight face.
Well, I mean, the shower is hard enough.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've read Bram Stoker's book, but from what I recall, there's very little romanticism in it, and I think that was probably something that got injected along the way, because the 30s version, Todd Browning's, there was mystique, there was a little bit of an attraction there, but it wasn't overtly sexual. Not like Gary Oldman's Batman or Dracula, and not in this. And it seems kind of, it's a staple now. If Dracula's not wooing women and biting necks and sucking blood, then it feels like there's something missing, when really I don't think it was there in the first place.
Yeah, but the scent of desire and, fluids and bodies coming together and that type of puncturing bodies and things like that, like, I think it's all in there, but it's just weird when they actually make it like about sex, which is kind of, I guess, what this, you know, the big issue I guess I have with this film,
yeah,
is that it's like all surface stuff, you know. So, you know, he has sex, but there's actually no reason or meaning for it, other than they want to make a sex scene, maybe, because who knows why.
Yeah,
but it doesn't play into any of the mythology, the story, the logic, or the character. It's a strange thing to add. I mean, you have the sense of desire, and you know, people giving over to their animal nature, losing themselves to someone else, things like this. But it's never literal, and they turn it into like a literal thing in there.
I don't know. I think I'm not sure when it developed. I feel like it was heavily influenced by the Hammer films. Because I feel like over the course of the Christopher Lee Draculas, I think like in his original Dracula, the 58 Dracula, still kind of just a kind of monster character, but he becomes more suave and rakish over the series, and more, you know, he talks a lot more, you know, he becomes more eloquent and stuff, because some of the early movies, he doesn't like really talk that much either, and he is kind of still portrayed as this kind of monstrous figure. It becomes more romantic figure throughout, and then I think it just kind of took hold, and then suddenly, and like, you know, obviously, like you say, like the Bram Stoker's Dracula, the Coppola one, you know, really doubles down on that kind of element of it, and then since then it's just become a thing.
Yeah exactly. Well, and another Dracula film that's supposed to be amazing and I have not seen is Blackula, which would have been around the Hammer times. Well, I would say it's 70, so 12 years later or so. Have either of you guys seen that? Does it play into the sexual nature of Dracula?
It's ages ago since I've seen that movie, so I can't remember it properly, if I'm being honest. I think so. I feel like it does. I think I feel he's pretty charismatic and kind of romantic. I don't know. Mike, have you seen Blackula?
No, I've never seen all of it. I've seen bits and pieces of it. So I can't really have a strong read or opinion on that one. Other than it always sounded like a cool movie when I saw it at the video store. I always wanted to watch it and I never did.
So I just can't see that exploitive genre of blaxploitation and all that stuff not embracing some other, you know, taboo subject, which would be, I guess, old white Dracula having sex with people. Now Blackula is going to go there. I don't know. Maybe I'm putting hopes on a film I haven't seen yet, but
I remember it being fun. Like I remember it being like an entertaining movie, but like I say, it's quite a long time since I've seen it, so I can't.
Well, there's a question right there: is how many Dracula films are there? And I'm not just saying like Dracula is a side character. I mean like proper. This is about Dracula.
Oh, I think Dracula is the most adapted character. Like certainly one of the most adapted characters. I think it's him, Sherlock Holmes, and then I don't know after that. I suppose there's long-running kind of Japanese film series. There's obviously like Godzilla and like the Tsutoshi films and stuff like that. But like, yeah, I mean, Dracula has got to be one of the most adapted for sure.
Google tells me there's at least 60.
That's why. Just pure straight-up Dracula movies. That's not like the ones that have him as a side character, or like the Nosferatu movies as well, which are Dracula movies but like with a different name.
Well, maybe it's Dracula 2000 because there's 1999 before this.
Yeah, it was nothing to do with the year at all. That was just pure coincidence.
That's right.
Oh man, I forgot that Guy Madden made a Dracula film. Guy Madden and then Werner Herzog.
Damn. I like the Werner Herzog one a lot.
Oh yeah, that's the remake of Nosferatu. Yeah, yeah. The Herzog one's great.
Yeah, it's great.
Because didn't Carl Dreyer? I didn't see Vampire yet, but I don't know if that's a Dracula story specifically. But it feels like a lot of these major directors at least have one Dracula film.
Yeah, it is. The Dreyer one is. It's a really interesting one.
Okay. Yeah, Murnau, Herzog. Like, man, these are not small people making little Dracula films.
Yeah, for sure.
That's wild.
So I think there's probably not a lot more to say about Dracula 2000, but we'll maybe wrap up with just like little kind of final thoughts of go to you first, Mike. What was your favorite thing about Dracula 2000, and what was your least favorite thing about Dracula?
My favorite thing was I didn't know Nathan Fillion was in it, and when I saw him, I was really happy to see him in an early role. And then during the credits to see sort of these people that I really like their work, like I was mentioning before, the production designer, the the costume designer, some of the stunt team, some of who I have, you know, talked about working with in the past. So it was just really cool to see some of their work on screen. And it was a film that I could watch while I did other things, which is sometimes what you want when you're watching a movie. So, you know, those are my favorite things about it. The least favorite thing was probably it just felt like really miscast, and the story has all these weird moments and threads which don't really add up to a greater sum. So that was a little frustrating.
Okay. And Braden, same question.
Yeah, what I liked about it, I love the mythology of stuff. I love when, you know, authors or directors tag on a little something, like Vlad Tepes in Bram Stoker's Dracula. I thought that was cool, and maybe not for the purist, but I like the Judas Iscariot part. I love a lot of the little throwbacks, like Nosferatu's skull and the Carfax Abbey naming of the storefront, and all those little things that if you know the story before, it's a little Easter egg treat. I know my wife loves seeing vitamin C in something. That's not totally common these days. And what did I
wasn't aware of that. So like when I was reading stuff about it and people keep mentioning this, like a vitamin C pop star in it, and it, like, you know, that was a kind of common thing in 2000 movies, but I wasn't aware that she was like a pop star, because I don't think like vitamin C was ever like a thing in the UK.
Yeah, she had like some graduation song that I think for about the span of 4 years it was everyone's graduation song, so that's where that lives. But I don't know. What I didn't care for is I think it does fall into a couple of the trappings of the era, and it did feel compromised to reach the widest target audience possible. Still being specific to, you know, the teenagers and a male audience. It kind of saps a lot of ideas away from it and becomes unfocused. And in turn, you know, it doesn't stay with you as long as it could have if you took a really bold choice and went all the way with it. So that was too bad.
Absolutely. I think, like, part of me loves just what a kind of time capsule movie it is. Like, I like all that kind of music. I like the soundtrack of the movie. I think it's, just a movie that just looks and sounds and feels very much 2000, kind of late 90s, early 2000s. And that's kind of a fun element for me. And I think, in, you know, from the vantage point of 2020, I just feel like my least favorite thing about it was just the kind of creepy feeling I got that I know it was ordered to be kind of sexed up, and some of those kind of scenes kind of stick out for me of what interventions that I'm assuming in my head that might have come from Weinstein's fingers.
I know that it's disturbing to see his name on films now, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I don't love it, which is too bad for all the other people that worked on the film, but what are you going to do, man? It definitely tweaks you in a bad way.
Especially for, at least Scott, you and I being like pretty impressionable kids during the 90s. I think we're roughly the same age. Yeah. How many Miramax films have come out, and how many of those things kind of fall into your heart as a favorite film, Good Will Hunting or something? And now when you see it, it's just, you get that bitter taste in your mouth.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. There's so many of those movies that are so close to my heart, you know, particularly things like Pulp Fiction and Clerks and, you know, stuff like that. Seeing that logo at the start is not the best.
Like Kevin Spacey films, man. It's like some of my favorite films are Kevin Spacey films. And now I have to like turn off part of my brain to just enjoy it.
Yeah, it's one of those weird things. Like I feel like I can watch some Kevin Spacey movies, but not other Kevin Spacey movies. Like the thing of, I've got Glengarry Glen Ross on DVD, and it's one that I'm kind of like, yeah, I can still rewatch this, but I also have like Usual Suspects. And because I know there's a creep on the screen and a creep behind the camera, it's like, well, I don't know. I can't go back to it now.
Glengarry Glen Ross, that's an episode unto itself.
Not on this show, but if I ever get like I ever do another podcast, you
know. totally, I love that film.
You can dig
I think, I think the reason you could watch that. Glenn Ross. Sorry, Mike. What was that?
Oh, sorry, that wasn't me.
Oh, I talked over someone. I was just gonna say, I think with Glengarry Glen Ross, the reason you could watch it so easily is there's about five separate actors that are at the top of their game, firing on all cylinders, is just unparalleled, man. I love that movie.
Yeah, I think it's a great movie too. But I just want to thank you both for coming on the show again and talking to me about Dracula 2000. I've had a lot of fun, and I hope the listeners at home have also had a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for having me on, man.
Yeah, thanks. It's always fun to talk about movies. We'll keep doing it.
Do it more. Work harder.
I'm already putting out an episode of Fortnite, and I'm doing this once a month now. Anyway, listener, if you want more episodes of New Horror Express, please feel free to email me at info@newhorrorexpress.com or hit me up on @newhorrorexp or go over to my Facebook page, New Horror Express, and tell us if you want more of this. If it's not, you're not getting enough New Horror Express in your life. And please do remember, the best way that you can support the show is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. But that is all for this episode of New Horror Express. Please join us again next month on this Guilty Pleasure series for our look at Scream knockoffs, where you can either pick Valentine or Cherry Falls.
Nice.
Until then, see ya.